Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. That's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of the program, we'll be talking about bankruptcies and the credit crisis. And our guest for the program is Robert Lawless. He is a professor of law here at the University of Illinois College of Law. He is a nationally known expert in bankruptcy and corporate law and has published many articles on the two topics. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about trends in bankruptcy. One thing that we know is that over the last couple of years, filings have been going up. It's his prediction that they'll be up again for 2009. We'll talk a little bit about that, perhaps some of the factors driving the increase in filings. We'll try to talk a little bit about the changes to the bankruptcy law that went into effect in 2005, and also the possibility that now the new Obama administration will be changing the law again, or at least propose changes in response to the current financial crisis that we're dealing with. Any and all of that, questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455. That's our local number here. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just keep their questions brief, try to keep their questions brief so we can get in as many callers as possible, but certainly you're welcome to call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is one of seven regular contributors to the blog Credit Slips. So if that's a subject that interests you, you could take a look at that. That's a discussion that deals with credit and bankruptcy. He's also a member of the Consumer Bankruptcy Project, which is a long-term study looking at people who file bankruptcy. And we're glad to have you here. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me, David.
One of the things I guess we could talk about just here to start out with is the filings over the last couple of years. And one thing I know from having read the blog is that filings were up pretty significantly from 2007 to 2008.
That's right. And we're going to probably go up again in 2009. They're going back to the level they were before the 2005 bankruptcy law passed, which temporarily depressed filings. That bankruptcy law didn't really do anything to address the underlying economic conditions that caused people to file bankruptcy, so there was no reason to expect that the decline right after the 2005 bankruptcy law was anything but temporary.
Mm-hmm. Just to remind people, there are different kinds of bankruptcy, and it depends upon whether you're talking about an individual or a business, and also the circumstances, whether that entity is going to continue or not, and they're known by the numbers, and
right,
probably people are used to hearing about right, Chapter 7 and Chapter 11 and Chapter 13. Just very briefly, the ones that you hear about most often, what are the differences between these numbers?
Well, let me even back up to even a more fundamental point, right? There's two ways you can repay your creditors through a bankruptcy case. One is to turn over your assets, let them get sold. Of course, you're allowed to keep some and that we exempt. You sell those assets, the proceeds are distributed to creditors. That's what's called a reorganization. Or you can repay your creditors out of future income. It's called a reorganization. And consumers and businesses liquidate, sell their assets through Chapter 7. So when you hear Chapter 7 bankruptcy, that's what that's about. That can, again, be for consumers or businesses. Reorganization, the idea of paying your creditors in the future through your future income, that's done through Chapter 11, mainly for businesses, although higher income individuals file Chapter 11 as well. And for your average everyday consumer, they use Chapter 13 to pay their creditors through out of their future income. There's also a special chapter called Chapter 12 for family farmers that is a reorganization provision, has some provisions that are try to make it a little bit easier for the family farmer to reorganize and pay their creditors out of their future income.
Mm-hmm. So basically the difference here is whether or not you think there's going to be future income and that you'll have some possibility to pay creditors something in the future. That is compared to people who say, well, I'm not sure or maybe I won't, and all I can do is allow you to take what I've got and see what you can get for it, and then someone will make some determination about how creditors are paid out of whatever that yields.
That's basically right, and that someone is actually the bankruptcy law that Congress passes, and I guess we're going to talk about here in a little bit. There's a very set priority scheme about which creditors get paid first and second and third and so forth. And also, though, one thing we should highlight is that it's not entirely up to the debtor as to which chapter they get to choose. The law tries to make sure that debtors that can pay do pay and end up in Chapter 13. One of the changes in the 2005 law was to try to shift more people into Chapter 13 and force more repayment. People who study bankruptcy law bankruptcy filers didn't really think there were a lot of people out there who were filing Chapter 7 who could really repay. But nevertheless, the law got passed, and a recent study that we've done suggested that the law didn't really shift people into Chapter 13, at least high-income people, as the law's proponents had promised.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to come back to that, mm-hmm. because I want to talk about those changes, what people said they thought would be the result, and then perhaps what the result was. But just to go back to these various kinds of bankruptcies, and I think that also one of the things that I saw on the blog was that overall the bankruptcy filings are up. But then if you look at these various types, that Chapter 11s are really up.
That's right.
Is there some particular reason why particular kinds of bankruptcies have gone up so much?
Well, different bankruptcies go up for different reasons. The Chapter 11s tend to be the business bankruptcies, and I think the obvious explanation for that is the economy.
Right.
Also, the credit crisis affects both consumer filings and business filings. As credit tightens up and people are no longer able to borrow, whether it's a consumer or a business, they end up in bankruptcy court because they're no longer able to stave off the day of reckoning with more borrowing.
Yeah. And you're looking at, I think that in 2008, the number of filings was a bit over a million.
It was actually just short of 1.1 million.
Okay. And now you're projecting, and of course, nobody really knows, but your projections are for 2009 is even a little bit more than that, like 1.4?
Looking at the trends and looking at the number of filings per day and extrapolating, you're looking at about 1.4 million bankruptcy filings in 2009. There's one caveat to that projection, though, which is that if Congress changes the bankruptcy law here in the early part of 2009, I think that 1.4 million figure is all bets are off. That's not going to happen. We'll probably have substantially more filings than 1.4 million.
Yeah. To talk about what happened in 2005 with the changes there, I think at the time, you know, depending upon who you were, you might have argued that either this was a good thing or a bad thing. There was, I think, on the one hand, seemed to be some concern that people were filing for bankruptcy, particularly because they had high levels of consumer debt, and that they were using that essentially as a dodge to avoid payment. So they were avoiding paying their debts. And they're people that they owed the money to weren't getting their money. And some people argued that what would happen here is that if people were going to file for bankruptcy, they would be expected to pay. And I think that some people were concerned that actually it would make it more difficult, particularly for individuals, to file for bankruptcy. And they would have expected that actually there would be fewer filings after that. Now, it may again tell you something about where we are now, the fact that we have so many. But what do you think about all those various arguments that had been made around these changes in 2005, and particularly what people said they thought would happen and what actually happened?
Well, the proponents of the bill, just to be clear, were the consumer credit industry. Yeah. It was an industry bill. It was opposed by most everyone who was intimately familiar with bankruptcy lawyers, bankruptcy judges, bankruptcy professors. Of course, it wasn't uniform, but most of the experts thought that this law was a bad idea. And they didn't see the abuse in the system. There were academic studies that looked for the abuse in the system. Those studies found that maybe 2% of filers could afford to pay more in bankruptcy, but we were talking about a massive change in the law to maybe catch 2%. The law was passed nonetheless. I think the people who pushed it really, although the rhetoric was along the lines of what you're saying, we need to get the can-pays, you know, what we've been calling the can-pays, people who were able to pay but just were unwilling. Mm-hmm. We need to get those can-pays into Chapter 13 and force them to pay a little bit. That was their rhetoric, but I think they knew that that was not really going to be the effect. And really, I think what we've seen as the effect is about what the law was designed, which was to delay the amount of time before people file bankruptcy. The 2005 bankruptcy law made it more expensive to file bankruptcy because attorneys have much greater burdens now under the 2005 law, and naturally it costs more to use an attorney. There are also some new fees. You've got to go through credit counseling now before you file bankruptcy. That costs a little bit of money. The cost of filing bankruptcy has gone up about 50% since the 2005 laws been passed. And just like anything, people use less of it when it's more expensive, and they delay the decision to file longer because it's more expensive. And what that means is that they're in this situation where they're racking up high default fees, they're racking up high interest rates, they're racking up high penalties, and which are some of the biggest profit centers of the consumer lenders.
Mm-hmm. Well, for those people who advocated the changes, did they get, I guess maybe one question would be, did they get what they wanted?
I think let me back up something that I've done, right? Okay. Which is I've just been monolithic about the consumer credit industry, which is, of course, it's not monolithic. There are home lenders, there are car lenders, and there are credit card companies. I think the big winners were the credit card companies. I think the car lenders came off pretty well, and probably the losers in the reform in terms of the consumer lenders were the mortgage industry because people have less ability now to deal with their credit card debt in the bankruptcy. That makes it much more difficult for them to get rid of that credit card debt and deal with their home mortgage debt. I'm not claiming that the bankruptcy bill caused the mortgage crisis, but as you look back in terms of the political winners and losers of the 2005 law, I think home mortgage lenders on the creditor side were the losers, and the credit card companies were the winners.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Robert Lawless. He is a professor of law here at the University of Illinois at the College of Law. He's a nationally known expert on bankruptcy and corporate law, and has done a lot of writing on those subjects. And we're talking here this morning about bankruptcy. And if you have questions, you can call us 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let's talk about particularly the changes in the law and what that meant for people who owe a lot of money on their mortgages and can't pay, what it means for them, what it means for the people that they owe the money to, and then perhaps we can also talk about how things might change to try to deal with the fact that right now, if people are in a really tough, individuals are in a really tough place, it might well be that thing that's the problem. It's their mortgage that's now has gotten them into trouble. Anything else that you could say about the law as it stands now and how it either addresses or doesn't address the problem of somebody who's being crushed by their mortgage?
Well, one rule that applies to all types of bankruptcies is that you have to pay your debts for which there's collateral. If you don't, the deal you've made with the bank is they can take the collateral back. That's true whether it's your car or whether it's your home. In Chapter 13, you're allowed to repay your creditors over time, and the bankruptcy judge has the power to, if you will, rewrite the contract you've made with the lender. If it's some extent it's your car. One of the things the 2005 bankruptcy law did was limit the power of judges to deal with automobile loans. It's one of the reasons I think the automobile lenders were winners and the mortgage lenders didn't come off as well in the 2005 law. But one thing, power that bankruptcy judges have never had is to adjust the home mortgage through Chapter 13. And one of the proposals to deal with the mortgage crisis is to give bankruptcy judges that power with several thoughts. First of all, it will give people the power to go into Chapter 13 and modify a home mortgage. Second of all, it will give people some bargaining leverage with their home mortgage lenders as they try to deal with crushing mortgage debt and perhaps be able to reach a solution short of a bankruptcy filing. Mm-hmm. And those two goals are really what's driving this legislative push in Washington, D.C. to change the rules of Chapter 13.
So do you think that that's going to happen?
I think it's going to happen. I think it's more likely than not. I don't think it's a certainty. I think it's, if I had to bet, I think I would bet that it's going to happen. The Democrats have been pushing this for well over a year and a half now. The Obama campaign came out in favor of it. The Democrats in Congress would like to attach this proposal to the economic stimulus bill. The Obama administration is doing the dance that presidential administrations always do with Congresses, which is they want a clean stimulus package. They want something that's not going to be junked up with other provisions, and they're trying to keep this provision out of the economic stimulus package. The Democrats in Congress are trying to make it a part of it, And, you know, we'll see how that plays out. But I think even if it doesn't become part of the economic stimulus package, there's a lot of interest on Capitol Hill and at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue in getting this changed to Chapter 13. So I think it's more likely than not that it'll pass.
Yeah. I would think that there would be a lot of people who would favor it. Certainly anybody who was arguing for the interests of consumers, I would think, would favor it. People who are concerned about folks who are in very difficult economic straits for this reason, I would think, would favor it. And actually, you would think that one party that might well favor it would be the banking industry, the people who have made the loans, because you'd have to think that really what would they want? Do they really want to have all this property on their hands that they end up with because people can't pay their mortgages and so they have to default and the bank takes the property back? Or would they like to get something? Would it be better for them instead of holding all this property that they can't do anything with, or it's difficult to do anything with? Wouldn't it be better to have people pay something? Keep those people in their homes. That's good. Get some cash flowing to the banks. That's good. They don't have to deal with having all these houses that now they would have. You'd think that the lenders would think, yeah, this is good. Maybe not ideal, but this is better than us having to repossess all these houses.
Well, the lenders are very much against this piece of legislation, with one exception, and that's Citigroup, who announced that they had reached a deal with members of Congress to support a piece of legislation under certain conditions. And I think one of those conditions shows why the lending industry is opposed to this uniformly, is they're not thinking so much about what's happening right now with people losing their homes, but they're thinking about what happens after we've come out of this crisis, and this is now part of the bankruptcy law. If it becomes part of the bankruptcy law, home lenders are going to lose an important piece of leverage that they have over homeowners, which is the home is worth more to the borrower than it is to the bank. Mm-hmm. And people will go to great lengths in usual times to try to stay in their home. And that great lengths that people will go to give the home mortgage lenders the ability to really put the screws to people when they're in dire financial straits and get as maximum amount of repayment as they can. And I think what they're concerned about is not the short term. I think they see all the good things that you see that would happen in the next, let's say, 2 to 3 years, but they're worried about 10 years or 15 years down the road if this change becomes part of the bankruptcy law. And interestingly, one of the things that Citigroup would agree to would be they would agree to this change only if it applied to mortgages that had already been written, not if it applied to mortgages going forward.
Uh-huh. Well, I suppose that would be one question. Could you write this in a way? I don't suppose you could write this in a way that said the change would be temporary. You could
write it in a way that's temporary. Of course, Citigroup's proposal in a way is a temporary change. Is the mortgages that are out there get paid off, the law will just eventually stop having any effect.
Yeah. That, I guess I'm, I still think, you know, that I guess I really don't understand why it is that everybody doesn't think that it's a good thing to give the judges the power to try to rework mortgage agreements so that everybody gets something, again, so that people get to stay in their houses and the people who hold the mortgages get something. I mean, I guess I can see your point about the industry saying, well, that would be good for right now. That would be good for the next couple of years, maybe. But what happens, you know, 10 years from now? I guess, though, I still find myself wondering why it is the judges don't already have that kind of authority to modify mortgages.
Well, they haven't had it since 1978, when the current bankruptcy law went into effect. Mm-hmm. The argument is that lending costs will rise if judges are given this power. It's not clear that that's going to be the case. That's always the argument that's made by the lending industry, that lending costs will rise if some pro-consumer rule gets passed, and rarely do we see that actually come to pass. I really do think truly that over the long run, this power that home lenders have, because the home is worth more to the borrower than to the lender, is really a very powerful economic position to be in. And the economic concept it's referred to as it's the hostage value of the house, mm-hmm. right, for reasons that should become readily apparent, right? The house is so valuable, it's like a hostage that you'll pay a ransom for, and this ransom is a very valuable economic asset in the hands of the home lender.
We have a caller here. We'd welcome others. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And our first caller here is in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions, maybe it's just clarifications. With regard to many of the homes these days that have been having defaults on their mortgages and things like that, there was a study recently that suggested that even with a reorganization of the mortgage and the terms of the mortgage by the banks, that so many people bought houses way beyond their means that they can't even afford, even if it were to be reorganized, to afford the payments that are necessary to pay for those houses. So even if you give the power of that ability to the judges, what can they actually do if, in fact, the many of the consumers who bought houses beyond their means can't even afford them anyway? And then, so you can comment on that point. But then the second thing I was wondering about, I seem to recall there were hits to your credit rating, right, if you do declare bankruptcy, at least for individuals, and I wasn't sure about businesses. But and then there was terms of years where that would be on your quote-unquote credit record, and then that would affect you in borrowing. So when you do declare bankruptcy, you're really kind of hurting yourself for the future by doing so. So it's really not the best way to go for some people. So if you can make any comments on that, I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right.
Those are both two great points. First, the idea that let's talk a little bit about the idea that a lot of people still aren't able to stay in their home even after some modification of the mortgage. I think the study to which the caller referred was a study of voluntary modifications between a bank and a borrower. And one possibility, of course, is that many of those modifications didn't just go far enough. The bankruptcy courts would have probably greater power to make deeper changes in the mortgage to give homeowners a better chance to stay in their home. But the caller is right that at the end of the day, a lot of even with a Chapter 13 change, and we call it the Chapter 13 cram down, the idea that the judge can cram down the provision over the objection of the creditor. Mm-hmm. Even with this so-called Chapter 13 cram down, it's not going to be some panacea where all of a sudden millions of people are going to stay in their homes that weren't going to be able to stay in their homes before. I think it will help. I think it will provide – it's a tool that can be used with the current situation. But the caller is right to suggest it's not a panacea and it's not going to solve everybody's problems. The second question about, well, is bankruptcy right for everybody? And again, that's a great question. No, it's not right for everybody. It is a negative mark on your credit score. But of course, by the time someone is in the financial shape where they need to declare bankruptcy, their credit score is often in such bad shape that a bankruptcy filing isn't going to affect it that much anyway. There's this kind of this wisdom that, well, you shouldn't file bankruptcy because it hits your credit score. But I think people fail to remember that, well, at this point, your credit score is already just about as low as it could probably get anyway. And if your credit score isn't in that kind of shape, well, then the caller's right. Maybe you need to consider some alternatives to bankruptcy. It's not a solution for everybody. One of the important things I think people should think about before they file bankruptcy is whether after bankruptcy, whether you're going to be taking in more income coming into the house than expenses going out. Because if you're not in that situation, after you file bankruptcy, you're just going to start racking up more debts, but you're going to lose the ability to file bankruptcy again for 8 years. So one of the important things I think people need to ask themselves before whether they're going to file bankruptcy is, okay, after bankruptcy, am I going to be better off? Am I going to be in a financial shape where my inflows are going to be more than my outflows and I can start living without building up debt to pay for gasoline and clothing and groceries?
Yeah. Well, I think that this gets an important point because I think that particularly people who are in the credit counseling area who are trying to work with people who have a lot of debts, they seem to make the point that said, look, let's see what somebody can do to help you work something out, because if you can avoid filing for bankruptcy, that's a good thing. You don't want to do that just casually because of the consequences that you that you talk about. So I suppose one thing, one important point is that, well, if you can avoid it, do. But this gets at the idea that I think that particularly as people were talking in 2005, some people who were arguing for the changes to the bankruptcy law made it sound like there were a lot of people out there who were just profligate spenders who racked up all kinds of debts and then said, well, I don't need to worry about dealing with my debtors. I can always file for bankruptcy. And I'm not sure that that was ever really true, that there were a lot of people who were just filing just because of that. Well, I don't want to pay what's owed and I could just file for bankruptcy and it's no big deal. Were there ever a lot of people like that?
No, there were never a lot of people like that. There's always been a very, very small minority of the bankruptcy system. And one of the things that got lost in the 2005 debates is that there were provisions already in the existing law that would force people into Chapter 13 when they filed bankruptcy and had the ability to repay. The judges had a great deal of discretion to push people into Chapter 13 or even to dismiss their cases outright when they believed it'd be an abuse of the bankruptcy system.
Yeah. And the other thing, maybe this is getting into a slightly different topic, but I think that it's the case, you know, particularly for people who have a lot of consumer debt, that the people that they owe the money to would rather have something than nothing. So you wonder, short of bankruptcy, how many debtors the creditors, people on the other side, how many of the creditors would actually be willing to try to come to some sort of agreement with people that owe them money and might indeed be willing to accept less that was owed in order to get something. And then that would also be a way for individuals to forestall bankruptcy.
Well, that's certainly right. What you're saying is certainly right. But I think there are two points that we need to make there, with one with the credit card companies and one with the home mortgage lenders. First, with the credit card companies, this old kind of quaint model of the debtor-creditor relationship where the creditor makes money by lending you money and then you paying it back with interest, and the interest is the profits, that model's gone. And with the most profitable customer for the credit card company is the customer who doesn't pay on time, who is chronically late, who is behind in payments and is racking up the highest interest rates, the biggest fees, and the biggest penalties. The credit card companies are making plenty of money off those people, regardless of whether the underlying principal is repaid. There are stories of bankruptcy judges dealing with claims from credit card companies where the claim is a multiple of 3 or 4 times of what the original debt was. And the credit card company says, well, this is all penalties and fees. So I think creditors will often work with debtors, but there are incentives for some of the creditors not to do so. That was the credit card companies. The home mortgage lenders, I think, as you were talking about before, do have powerful incentives to try to work with homeowners. But as we've all learned, this word called securitization, where your home mortgage was sold off in a bundle to investors, They're the ones who actually now own the mortgage. And the people you send your check to, known as the mortgage servicer, may not have the power to deal with the modification, may not be able to deal with you. And one of the things, another reason I'm in favor of this bankruptcy bill is that it would cut through that red tape and give bankruptcy judges the power to make modifications, even if the mortgage was split up among a bunch of different investors.
Yeah. We have several of the callers here. We're at a little bit past our midpoint. Our guest, just to introduce once again, is Bob Lawless. He's professor of law here at the U of I. He's an expert in bankruptcy and corporate law, has done a lot of writing on both those topics. He's one of the 7 regular contributors to the blog Credit Slips, which is discussion of credit and bankruptcy. He's also a member of the Consumer Bankruptcy Project. That's a long-term study looking at people who file bankruptcy. And that's what we're talking about here this morning, bankruptcy, how that attaches to the credit crisis, what's likely to happen in Washington in terms of trying to address those concerns. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have several callers, and the next in line is in Champaign on line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I've been flabbergasted by the credit card industry for quite a while now. For one particular reason, I live in Japan quite a bit, and when I'm in Japan, and even when I'm not in Japan, I have a Japanese credit card. And Japanese credit cards do not have interest rates at all. It doesn't exist in the Japanese credit card industry, legally and otherwise, from what I understand. And whereas here, of course, we have interest rates, but we also have, you know, these odd provisions that credit card companies can make, that they can legally increase your fees at any time, at a whim, apparently, from what I understand, with most credit card agreements. And I just wonder, with this bankruptcy bill, why exactly is it that the credit card industry is so powerful that they can move through bills like this previous, that is 2005, right?
Yep.
That bill. It seems to me that they function as a loan shark industry, unless I'm missing something. I mean, isn't this basically how they're functioning? And why is it that legally no one has tried to come after them, including apparently most of the Democrats in the Congress?
Well, I think some of the reasons, those are all good questions. I think some of the reasons for that have to deal with the political history of the banking system and the way it developed to concentrate power of the banking regulation in the federal government as opposed to the states. The states aren't completely powerless, but the big player in the banking regulation is the federal government, and the federal government has been, because of the way it's structured, the credit card companies have had a great deal of influence. In terms of the question about loan sharking and this idea of how much interest rates here are being charged. There are proposals to have a national cap on interest rates, known as a usury cap. And people, we can't have that. That's market regulation. And you turn to them and say, well, we're talking about a 36% cap. And people say there are people who lend money at more than 36% interest rates that's not on TV in the some mobster movie. And I say, yeah, it happens all the time. The interest rates, the consumer interest rates in this country have gotten out of control. And I think there is some interest in the current Congress to do something about those high interest rates. Oh, and one other point with the credit card companies changing the terms of the credit agreement at will. That is true. They can currently do that, but in December, the Federal Reserve passed new regulations that will put an end to that practice, but they don't go into effect for another 18 months. So.
Oh, that's great, though. That's good to hear. Yeah. Thank you very much. And I, by the way, use a debit card. I refuse to use a credit card. But anyway, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. I think that certainly the credit card companies, that kind of branch of lending has long before now come in for a lot of criticism for making credit too easily available. That is, making it possible for people to rack up bills that perhaps they shouldn't. I guess I would expect, and you can tell me if it's true, that though over the last couple of years, that tendency of the credit card companies to say, oh, yeah, we'll give you a credit card. Here's your line of credit. Go out and spend your money and have a great time, that actually they're pulling back from that?
In the last 6 months, they've drastically pulled back.
Only in the last 6 months.
In the last 6 months. Consumer credit actually shrank in the third quarter of 2008, which was the first time in its history that it's been measured. When we talked about consumer credit tightening in the past, what we meant is it just didn't go up as much as it usually did. Mm-hmm. It actually went down in the third quarter of 2008, and we're waiting on the fourth quarter numbers from 2008 to come out. So just most recently have those consumer credit contracted, but again, if you look back at the broad sweep of history, and if you lay down a graph of the number of bankruptcy filings in this country, and put that over a graph of the amount of consumer credit outstanding, it's almost a 1-to-1 relationship. It's not surprising that over time, as consumer credit became more available and people were in more debt, that bankruptcy filings went up. It's almost a tautology. If you have debt, you're going to have more bankruptcy filings.
Yeah. All right. To another caller here. The next is someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It would seem to me, it has seemed that way for a long time, that when the bankruptcy law is as it is with the 205 measure, which makes it practically impossible to escape repayment, that this encourages lenders to make loans which they know are unsound, that are probably going to default, and that when they do this deliberately, it's really a form of predatory lending, and that they really should bear the loss, that's the only way that they will reform their act.
Well, I guess my reaction, I don't disagree with that necessarily, but Is that the consumer lenders have been making loans, many consumer lenders, you know, I keep talking monolithically like they're all the same, but many consumer lenders, even the big consumer lenders nationally, have been lending for years, knowing that a significant portion of their borrowers will be unable to repay, but they know they're still going to make a strong profit off the high interest rates and the penalty fees and that we've been talking about earlier. So I think that's already been there. The idea that they should bear the loss, well, they're not bearing a loss because they're making a great deal of profits off of a 28% interest rate and, you know, a late fee each month of $30. And you add all that up across a few million of customers, and as the old expression goes, it adds up to real money.
Yes. Well, I realized that they were making money, but it seems to me that this law maximizes and makes it impossible for someone who inadvertently and where they couldn't know that this, something happens, an accident, illness, that they can't escape the debt and they are in a horrendous position for the rest of their life.
Yeah, I agree that that law maximized their ability to wring those sorts of profits out of borrowers. I wish it had never been passed. I signed statements saying that I thought it was a bad idea, wrote about it on wherever I could. But I think the political reality is that if we're going to have changes to the bankruptcy law, it's going to be changes like the Chapter 13 rather than some wholesale change where we just repeal in its entirety the 2005 law. I wish that wasn't true, but the reality is that I don't think we're going to undo the 2005 law in its entirety.
Well, thank you, and I'm afraid you're right.
All right, thanks for the call. Just to pick up on one thing the caller said, if people were here, and I guess this goes to this question of how many mortgages continue to be held by the whoever originated the loan, and I think probably most of them are not. They end up going off into the secondary market. So I guess the question is, if people, lenders made loans to people that they knew couldn't pay, were they doing that thinking that, well, somehow it wouldn't have been the case. They were thinking, well, the bankruptcy law, we'll make sure we get paid. I think the more serious problem was they were making the loan and then they were passing the risk on to somebody else. If it was true they made a loan to somebody they knew couldn't pay and didn't care, they were thinking, well, that's not going to be my problem anymore. That was a big problem here.
Yeah, again, right, there are different types of consumer lenders. I think it was the credit card companies that are making their money off of the late fees, right. Although the mortgage industry isn't completely innocent on this. With the mortgage industry, the story is more along the lines of, I think, what you've just suggested. Interestingly, the banks that didn't sell their mortgages are the ones that are in the best financial shape now because they seem to have had, by and large, more prudent lending practices, and they were not extending credit irresponsibly. There was a paper we had a conference here at the University of Illinois back in May, and one of the professors presented a wonderful paper showing that loans that tended to get sold tended to be the ones that went into default, were most likely to go into default. No surprise there. Hmm. Right? It's only human nature to try to pass along risk to somebody else if you can get away with it. I think there's also another thing that was explored at this conference is kind of the organizational side of this, right? We're talking about big organizations. The organizations, of course, don't make the decisions. They're just pieces of paper, fictions that we've made up. Mm-hmm. They're real human beings in those organizations that make those decisions to lend. They make those decisions to lend, and then they either move up the corporate chain or they move on elsewhere. And by the time those decisions go bad, those lending decisions go bad, those human beings that made those decisions are gone. So I think there's also a real human side of this about the way humans make decisions and the way they act in the organizations when they make those lending decisions and the incentives they have that kind of created the perfect situation for this risk to be passed on to others and for bad loans to be made.
Other callers here. The next is in Champaign and on line number 3. Hello.
Thank you. I'd like you to explain what the situation would be or how, you know, law, as it's been rewritten, would affect a situation that is more realistic and a lot more frequent than those who pushed this legislation through would like to admit. But say you have someone who, you know, they paid off their house, they own it, paid off their car. They own that. Unfortunately, though, either were denied health insurance or had inadequate health insurance. They got ill, ran up catastrophic bills, medical bills, and then because they were too sick to work, they had to use credit cards for, basic necessities and ran that up really high. Now in a situation where they can't possibly, even if they're able to go back to work, and can't even assume that, they're never going to be able to pay off the, hundreds of thousands, if, not more than hundreds of thousands of dollars in bills that they've amassed. What happens to them then if they need to file bankruptcy?
Well, one of the things we see in the studies we do where we go out and interview and send surveys to people who filed bankruptcy is their medical problems, like you've described, are one of the leading reasons that we see people end up in bankruptcy court, either because of the money, the debts that they've had to incur, or because of the income loss because of their illness. In terms of this law, now hopefully that kind of debt, that medical debt, doesn't end up as a mortgage on your house. It's not a claim against your house. It's just like credit card debt. It's a promise to repay. And the law, one of the things we should make clear is that the bankruptcy law still has a discharge, that although it's more expensive to file and there's a little bit more hassle to file, that once you go through that process, there's still a bankruptcy discharge, which means that those creditors, after you've turned over your assets or your income, whichever it is, those creditors can no longer go after you for that debt. So the law still does provide relief. One of the myths that came out in the popular conception after the 2005 law was that bankruptcy was no longer available. That wasn't true. It's just more expensive. It's more hassle. But once you get there, you're going to find similar to relief. Once you go through all that, you're going to find similar relief to what there was before the 2005 law.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and on again to another Champagne caller, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a dear friend who has just gotten way over credit card debt, way over her head. Is it true that they cannot take a house and a car from you if you go through a bankruptcy? And the credit card company debts, is that a Chapter 11 or a Chapter 13?
So, first of all, the only creditors that can take your house or your car are the creditors that you have pledged those assets to as collateral.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you owe somebody money, they can always bring a court proceeding, and this is before you get to bankruptcy court, and the judge can send the sheriff out to seize assets that you own, which might be a car or might be a house. Similarly, in bankruptcy, if you own the house free of a mortgage or you own the car free of a car loan, the bankruptcy trustee will take those assets minus the exempt amount you're allowed to keep, sell them, will give you the amount that's exempt, and distribute those sales proceeds to the creditors. So the answer to your question is, can they take the house and the car as well? It depends. It depends on a lot of things. It depends upon whether they're collateral for a loan. It depends upon how much they're worth.
Just credit card debt.
Well, it still depends. If somebody had a $500,000 house and they declared bankruptcy, the bankruptcy trustee would sell the house and give that money to the credit card companies minus the exemption that the debtor is allowed to keep.
What is the exemption?
I was just sitting here thinking, and to be honest, I'm sorry, in Illinois, I've forgotten off the top of my head what the Illinois homestead exemption is. But it depends on many things, and what this was a point that I think, many people, some try to file bankruptcy without a lawyer, and it is a complex process. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. It's an expensive process. And the answer that it depends on so many things is one of the reasons that it's best to try to do this with a lawyer. In terms of the chapter to file, it doesn't matter what type of debt you have. In terms of what chapter you file, what determines what chapter you file is your income and your ability to repay.
Um, what are the guidelines? What income do you have to have before you're in 11 or 13?
Well, you wouldn't almost certainly be in – you would almost certainly probably not be in 11 unless the credit card debt is extremely high. You're probably talking about Chapter 13 or Chapter 7. And there's very, again, complicated rules. This is one of the reasons, again, it's good to have a lawyer. But as a general rule of thumb, if you're below the median income of your state, you can file Chapter 7. And you can find that information through the United States Department of Justice. Just type Department of Justice and bankruptcy, and you'll get the appropriate part of that website that'll give you those kind of numbers.
And what is expected, what is anticipated, what is hoped for under the new bankruptcy law?
You mean the one that's pending in Congress?
Right.
Well, the hope is, again, that as we talked about with an earlier caller, it's not going to be a panacea where everyone's going to stay in their homes, but the hope is that it will help several hundred thousand, if not several millions of people stay in their homes.
I was thinking more of the credit card aspect.
I don't think that that Congress will make huge changes to the bankruptcy law beyond this one specific change
that
dealing
with
home mortgages, right.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right. We will go to another caller here, and this is someone in Chicago. Line two.
Thank you. I
yes.
have to deal with the matter of the whole concept of a corporation. Well, one of the presidents has said the business of government is business. Well, to the extent that business has had some regulation, but then we see how oversight was lacking and it's gotten out of control, as you stated at some point. We have the whole matter of considering the corporation becoming another part or appendage of government. We have the executive, legislature, and judicial, but it seems as though the tail is wagging the dog. And to what extent do you think that the corporation is or should be in that position of power to do things? After all, we see the debacle that our economic system is in as a result of all this out-of-control things that have been going on. So would you comment about the matter of this corporation being considered another aspect of government to the point where it's so powerful?
Well, part of this, we were talking earlier, Citigroup had reached a deal for the bankruptcy bill to go through, and some people at the time commented, well, what's Citigroup to make a deal with with Congress? Are they another branch of government? And I think we all wish it weren't that way, but the reality is that Citigroup and the banking industry have powerful allies in Congress. And those allies, I should be clear, I disagree with them. We disagree on ideological grounds. They're not venal. They're acting what they believe the best interests of the country are. I think they're wrong. But Citigroup and its banking allies in the banking industry have strong allies in Congress, and they're able to block legislation. And if Citigroup announces that it will support the legislation, then those allies in Congress will back off. And that's just a reality of the political system that we have. And if we want it, I wish it weren't so, but if we want some changes, where we need to accept that and try to work the compromise.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're almost to the point here. We have to finish up. We've talked about the fact that there are some people in Washington who would like to see the change, this one change that we've talked about, change the bankruptcy law to give bankruptcy judges the authority to renegotiate a mortgage, to make it easier for people to stay in their homes, and that the lending industry is not maybe real sure about that, but I imagine there are people in Congress who would like to see that happen. And we've also talked about the fact that bankruptcies are up over the last couple of years, particularly businesses, Chapter 11s, and that probably we'll see more of that. Is there anything that people are contemplating in terms of changes to benefit not individuals in bankruptcy, but businesses in bankruptcy?
Actually, not at all. I have not heard any proposals to deal with businesses. One of the things that the 2005 bankruptcy law is that, although it was mainly discussed in the media as a consumer bankruptcy changes, there were a lot of changes to the business provisions. Mm-hmm. And it's become tougher for businesses to reorganize in Chapter 11. And we've seen, just last week, Circuit City announced that its Chapter 11 wasn't going to succeed and it's going to liquidate. And although it became much tougher for businesses, and especially small businesses, that's one of the things that I guess especially angered me about the 2005 changes is they were affirmatively hostile to small business. Mm. And although we've seen this law make it much tougher for businesses to reorganize in Chapter 11, there's really no discussion politically about rolling back some of those changes for businesses. It's all on the consumer side right now.
Well, does that surprise you at all, that particularly given where we are right now, that nobody's saying that maybe we ought to be doing something to help businesses that are struggling?
Debtors don't have a natural political constituency. There's no future Debtors of America lobby in Washington, D.C. So, no, as somebody who's observed this scene for now a couple decades now, it doesn't at all surprise me.
All right. Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest is Robert Lawless. He is professor of law here at the University of Illinois, well known as an expert in bankruptcy and corporate law, one of the contributors to the blog Credit Slip. So if you're interested in issues of credit and bankruptcy, you can take a look at that. He's also a member of a Consumer Bankruptcy Project. This is a long-term study looking at people who file bankruptcy. Thank you very much for being here.
Yeah, thank you, David.